Welcome to the Modern Slavery Pack podcast. My name is Jakub Sobik. We know that people affected by modern slavery are routinely excluded from research and wider discussions about the best ways to address the issue. So how can we co-create research to better align with the needs and interests of people with lived experience so that they can lead and direct it? And how can we better involve people with lived experience in the wider work addressing modern slavery? We now publish research that grapples with those questions. It was led by the University of Liverpool in close collaboration with the Modern Slavery Pack. It brought together a team of six consultants from communities affected by modern slavery from four different continents to co-produce six separate studies to address meaningful inclusion of people affected by modern slavery in very different contexts. Today we'll talk about the research. First, we'll talk with two researchers from the University of Liverpool about the project overall and the co-production that was at the heart of it. And then we'll talk with all six regional authors of individual reports about the engagement of lived experience in their context. You hear my colleague Harry Rye leading some of the interviews. As always, you can read all about the project on our website. For now, I hope you enjoy these conversations. All I can say is that it's a lot of food for thought. Thank you. We've got Dr. Alan Chichoncho, a research fellow at the University of Liverpool and at the Modern Slavery Pack, and Professor Alec Bulge, Professor of Politics at the University of Liverpool and Director of Research at the Modern Slavery Pack. Welcome to the podcast. Could you please tell us first about the context of the project, how it came about and what you wanted to achieve and what were the key objectives of the project?
Yeah, it's great to look back at how things started, because we're now nearly a year and a half, 2 years into this network that we've built. A network of experts, people with lived experience, people directly working on human trafficking and modern slavery. It really started off with a commission from the FCDO, Foreign and Commonwealth and Development Office, because they were under some pressure to respond to the critique that they're not really engaging people with lived experience, they're not really engaging those directly affected in their policies and programs. Or at least that was a criticism, and they agreed with that and agreed that they should do something about it. One of the things they did about it was to commission us to do some research on it. So that gave us a great opportunity to launch a research program. And me, Alan, and Wendy, who's not here, Wendy Asquith, we did that, and we started off by recruiting a set of experts, got some brilliant people wanting to join, but we limited it to five experts, later increased that to six, people from around the world who either have lived experience themselves and are working on policies or programs in this area, or people maybe who have particular sort of engagement with the topic, with NGOs, with governments, and can tell us about how engagement is happening in their contexts. So that was the initial sort of project. Fairly modest. It was like 6 months, but in pretty short time we created some really great outputs that I think sort of demonstrated the key principles, you know, that we need to think about when it comes to good, high quality, meaningful engagement with lived experience.
You employed a slightly different approach to developing the research agenda for this project, and you had a slightly unusual way of working as a research team. There was a whole project team and there were kind of separate six projects. Could you tell us a little bit more how that worked?
So in this second round of the work, we wanted to design the project in a way that the consultants would be part of the designing process, and then also going on to implement the project. Because in the first phase, we had sort of a clean agenda of what all the teams would look out for. But this phase, we wanted to be more flexible with the agenda. Yes, we had the starting ideas of what individuals could go into to look for, but we wanted to give the different consultants flexibility to inform the process of coming up with the research projects. So we began by having these conversations, weekly conversations, of how we wanted them sort of take leadership of their projects. So they went on to create concept notes, which we reviewed and gave comments and feedback, and then they went back and refined until they were happy with the project idea they wanted to pursue. So the good thing with this network is that we have two NGOs, and then we have the other as individual consultants. So they come from rich backgrounds. Some of them have lived experience. So they were so excited about coming up with their own the projects. So we ended up seeing that co-designing the project was very useful for us, in the sense that people began owning the projects. We could see the tone changing. We could see how they explained the projects changing. We could see that they took on a different understanding altogether. They understood that they were going to create projects based on what they could sort of connect with from their context. So collaboration, we saw that when we trust consultants or partners or collaborators, they can sort of open up, they can sort of think and reflect on what is important. That's why we have ended up with projects where consultants were able to sort of think through what they felt was important, what they felt they wanted to communicate in the sector of anti-trafficking.
We're going to dive in into all six separate projects shortly, but could you tell us the key lessons that you've learned as a whole project?
Yeah, I can start off with that. I mean, I think there's some lessons that have come out, because obviously all of these projects, very different, as Alan said, very distinctive, but they are connected by one thing, which is, you know, how do we better engage people with lived experience? And I think the lessons come into sort of different categories. First of all, you know, we found that there are examples. We have case studies and evidence of how internal organizational processes, or how you work as an organization, can be radically improved if you do that in an inclusive way that includes people with lived experience. So you can develop organizational policies, practices, by sort of almost walking the walk. If you're interested in benefiting a certain group, you need to include that group in how you develop those services. So that's the first set. Second set was really about how we react to this such a dynamic and evolving situation of exploitation. And really just highlighting that the best people to tell us about how things are changing and how things, maybe new forms of exploitation are happening, is by speaking to those directly affected. But that does bring challenges, because we're talking about people who might be, you know, quite close to have been exploited, might have only recently been able to extract themselves from that situation. So lots of challenges, but still, you know, really the best route to responding properly to new challenges. So that's lessons for policymakers and practitioners. And then finally, just how we communicate. The power of communication. If we're going to engage with different groups, people across different sort of backgrounds, contexts, communication becomes absolutely key. And we found in the previous round of research and this round of research, just the incredible power of communication when it's done correctly. So that might be in how we do storytelling. It might be in which words we use to describe what we're trying to address. We know there's some problems with things like the words modern slavery in certain countries. We know that survivor has more resonance in some places than in others. And we've now have more evidence about exactly sort of which types of communication work best. So those are the three sort of sets of sort of insights and lessons. But I think there was another whole set of lessons around co-production, which maybe Alan is well placed to talk about, you know, how we do the research and what we've learned from each other.
when we began this phase, we wanted to sort of speak to the issue of tokenizing partners or tokenizing people with lived experience in research. That's why from the start we wanted to design this project to be a meaningful one. When we talk about collaboration, when we talk about co-designing, how does that look like in practice? It is basically trying to give power to the people on the project, especially those who are sort of trying to get on the ladder. We talk about professional research. How do you go and conduct research and then do it in a meaningful way? So Alex and I, we sort of took a back seat for us to see how the consultants would come up to design the project, how they would think through issues of ethics. Because, considering that they were coming from different backgrounds and contexts, ethics would not be the same for all the projects. So now when we think about the key lessons here is that survivor engagement, sort of, it helps to identify, expose, and then also address issues related to tokenization in research. When you come up with a research agenda that is not fixed, that is not going to box these professionals in a way, this is a narrative. This is what we want your narrative to fit in. When you sort of open up and then see how professionals with lived experience, with no lived experience, they sort all come together to contribute to a bigger theme of survivor engagement. So the other issue as well that stood out when we looked at our methodology is that when we talk about survivor leadership, sometimes it is a concept that is seen as it has to be done by a specific category of people. But now on our project, we saw that, yes, we had people with lived experience who actually went on sort of foreground the work themselves. The two NGOs that are led by people with lived experience, they were sort of setting pace for us. They were coming up with new ideas, with the like practices that we can rely on to disrupt what we are used to. So when you give people with lived experience, and in this case, we're talking about leadership, when you let them lead on a project, on a program, there is a way that we can learn more. We can sort of pause and reflect of why some practices are working for categories of people and some are not working for other categories of people. So the other thing as well that came up based on our methodology, that when you foreground and center lived experience, you can get nuances in the work. When you look at the reports we have been able to work on, that we'll talk about briefly, there are so many issues coming up, as Alex has talked about. We have new concepts. We have new understandings. We have a project by Chris Ash where in the first phase, we're able to identify the different tools, the different practices, the different guidelines that we rely on when we talk about survivor engagement. But Chris Ash comes in to interrogate what is in the field. How are those tools used? Who are they benefiting? Who are they leaving out? And that came about after we had sort of stepped back and said, what do you think is important in your work? What do you think you need to tell people in this sector? So when you foreground, when you center lived experience, we see different dynamics emerging in the field of human trafficking. Thank you.
That sounds great. We're about to hear all six of the individual researchers. For now, Alan and Alex, thank you very much. Our first guest is Chris Ash, Survivor Leadership Program Manager at the National Survivor Network, and they are the regional consultant for America and the US. Welcome to the Modern Slavery PEC podcast. Chris, tell us about your research, what you're doing in this project.
Sure. So last year in our research, we found that survivors often, when they wanted to engage in the movement to end trafficking as leaders, they felt like they were limited to just storytelling and further in very tokenizing ways that were about the needs and the benefit of the organizations and less so about the needs and benefits of the survivors. So this year, I focused my research on storytelling in general because we can't unring the bell of 20 plus years of anti-trafficking work but we can be imaginative and ask ourselves, what would an authentic survivor-driven storytelling tradition look like? Because we know that in communities, anywhere there are people, storytelling is how we learn, teach each other, preserve traditions, keep each other safe, and also the way that the trafficking movement is doing it is not doing any of those things. So I did interviews with survivors, people who have lived experience of human trafficking. Most of my interviewees are not people who regularly tell their stories in anti-trafficking spaces, but they are members of communities that have authentic, community-developed, community-centered storytelling traditions, whether it's an indigenous tribal community or a substance use recovery community or an LGBTQ or African-American community where they share stories to preserve traditions as part of healing to keep each other safe. And I asked them about what are the norms of authentic community storytelling traditions? What does that look like in your other communities? And then I was able to ask them, would you want to share your story of experiencing trafficking for social change? And they all said yes. And then I was able to say, what would that look like for you? If you got to determine the purposes your stories were used for, what would those purposes be? If you got to determine what elements of your story you wanted to highlight and what you wanted to tell stories about, what would that be? Parallel to that, I had a research assistant who did a review. We started with 30 different models of storytelling that we had found. We eliminated half of them due to relevance. So for the remaining 15, we looked through them to see, do they give guidance about ensuring that the person or community retains ownership over their own story? Do they give guidance about revoking consent? Do they give guidance about managing power imbalances? I would say maybe 9 of these were trafficking specific, but some of them were storytelling for social change with homeless youth. Some of them were about protecting indigenous intellectual property in the arts. So there were very diverse groups. And what we found from all of this is they do want to tell stories. And their two main areas and reasons they want to tell stories are for education and community connection. And with community connection, that's not public in the sense of being for the anti-trafficking sector. It's not about the sector. It's about people who are impacted. How can we help them feel less alone? Someone said, I think their way of framing it was, how do we use our stories to pull them out of the isolation that trafficking put them into? How do we build that connection? So that's an organic community one. And the interesting thing for me about education, one of them said something really insightful, which is that when people other than us tell our stories in the ways that they want them told, it's a cautionary tale. If you don't do things right, if you aren't aware, if you aren't careful, you could end up like that person. When we tell our stories to educate our communities and teach us about safety, it's a warning tale, which means that instead of saying, if you do things right, this won't happen, we say systems and communities are not always built to protect us. They have gaps. They have flaws. You could do everything right, and bad things could still happen to you. So how do you anticipate greater reactions in your community from people who would cause you harm or from systems that fail you so that you can make informed choices to keep yourself as safe as possible? I think it has a lot of really great potential for rethinking both how we do storytelling, how we navigate power dynamics, how we make sure that the stories that survivors are telling are their own and for their own purposes, and also for informed consent for storytelling.
That is so interesting. What I'm hearing is that there is a bit of a challenge to the anti-trafficking sector as a whole. Having worked in communications in anti-trafficking organizations, I know that we are the gatekeepers of survivor stories, and I know we're trying to change that, and I think we're at the beginning of the road to do that. But what would you say is the kind of next steps, and what needs to happen to let that gatekeeping role go a little bit and include people who we should be including and not exclude people who we don't want to exclude.
Yeah. I think we have a formula. I think we follow a formula that was created without impacted people in the first place. And the formula is you share your story and the story has a neat arc. It starts with when you become trafficked, because we're generally not interested in who you are as a whole person before that. We don't care what your favorite outfit was when you were a child or what record you played on over and over and made your parents lose their minds when you were little. We want to know how you got trafficked. Like it's extractive. It's pulling that piece of you out and putting it on a platter for others to consume. So I think this formula, you got trafficked. There was an intervention of some sort that we're either trying to raise money for, create policy around, and now things are beautiful and you're a perfect after picture and you never have bad days and your trauma is fully recovered. And this arc's just not realistic. It's also very Western. It's not realistic for a lot of survivors. And so I think maybe pausing and stepping outside of that formula, and instead of saying, here's the formula, here's what I need you to say, ask survivors, like, what do you want people to know about who you are? What do you want them to know about your experiences? And I also think in terms of comms that there's an opportunity to really engage with communities and to find out and to spend a lot of time listening and be like, what are the stories you're already telling? And how can we amplify some of those stories in ways that feel ethical and desired by you?
Yeah, I mean, one aspect of our work is that balance between normally we want to hear, or for example, the media, the journalists want to hear the stories of exploitation. What we're trying to focus on a little bit more is on what survivors think should happen. So we want to hear their expertise and informed opinion as people who experience trafficking. But what I'm also hearing is that there is a big need for some people to actually tell their stories, but just telling them on their own, in their own way. So it is slightly different than I'm actually kind of tend to look at this.
Yeah. One of the things that they said when I asked them what kinds of things would you want to tell stories about, one of the common responses from everyone was stories of services. I would like to tell stories about services that I received that were not helpful. I would like to tell stories of services that would have been helpful but that I couldn't access. So I think there's a lot of synergy with what you're saying around what do you think should happen. But we don't typically ask them, come and tell us your story about the services you couldn't access, because that doesn't center the rescuer or the intervention in the story. That centers the person and their struggle, which is a lot less likely to create warm, fuzzy feelings among donors and legislators and politicians. So, like, a lot of them want to tell you the stories of services, gaps, things that they had to crowdsource from their communities for safety because the funded nonprofits weren't providing them. These are stories they want to tell too. The other thing they said in addition to stories of services was that they wanted to tell stories that disrupt cultural narratives and stereotypes, because they felt like a lot of the stories that do get elevated in the sector tend to be really stereotyped, certain kinds of victims, certain ways trafficking happens. And the stories are being told to validate and ask for more support for certain kinds of interventions that a lot of these survivors felt weren't interventions that helped them in the first place. So to disrupt and show the need for different kinds of interventions, they want to tell stories that challenge those common narratives and kind of show more marginalized experiences that don't fit the arc quite as neatly.
Yeah, I think that's quite apt. We in the anti-trafficking sector, I think, like to look at ourselves as the ones who challenge the system. Maybe that's a good place to actually sit back and try to be challenged. Maybe that needs to happen. Thanks very much. A lot of food for thought. It was Chris Ash. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our next guest is Dr. Sutita Saharia. a regional consultant for South Asia. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please tell us about your project. We'd like to hear what you're working on.
All right. My project is based in India, in a frontline area in the state of West Bengal, which is on the east coast of India, bordering Bangladesh. So for the last couple of years at the University of Liverpool, we have been talking about engagement of survivors in policy and programs. Now, the idea about this project was to figure out how a frontline organization with very little resources, right on the ground, right in an area where the media says that 2,000 girls go missing every 6 months, how do they actually involve survivors in policy and programs? So I wanted to develop a case study, and that was the objective of the program, to learn from the grassroots, how do they do it, what are the gaps, and what can be done?
Right, and what have you been finding? Is the organization actually consciously intending to involve and meaningfully involve survivors in their work? How is that looking? What are you finding?
Strikingly and very impressively, the amount of work, the type of work that the local grassroots organization has been doing in an area with almost no resources is incredible. What we have learned is that when you talk about survivors' engagement in policy, her lived experience, a survivor's lived experience of trafficking journey, the process of trafficking, getting trafficked and then getting rescued is not important. That's good for criminal investigation, but for informing policy and program, the rehabilitation journey of the survivor is far more important because her problem increases manifold when she comes back home. The first problem she faces is stigma from her own community and own family. The families, in the process of getting her back, getting her rescued, they become poorer. They blame her for her situation. And in those communities, child marriage is very prevalent. The first question that comes to family's mind, how am I going to get my daughter married off? The community would call her a woman of bad character. They don't want her there. So there are a lot of needs. You know, sometimes she has no home because the family simply abandon her. So the housing needs, food needs, medical needs, you know, mental health needs, employment needs, stigma needs, her recreational needs because she's a person like all of us. So all these things. So you have around 10, 12 programs that needs to be in place to rehabilitate a survivor. But in the process, for example, if I need a house, I have to go to the local council. In India, there are four levels of governance at the state level, district level, national level. I have to make an application. So it's a process. So in that process, you learn about policy. You know, think of it this way. If I have to come to the UK, I have to apply for a visa. Now, once I know how to go about the process, I can help someone else who needs a visa to travel to the UK. Similarly, if I've been able to get a house or get victim compensation, which is a huge process, you know, you have to go to the police station, file an, first information report, you have to deal with lawyers, courts. This is not an easy thing for any citizen anywhere in the world. But when you go through that gruesome, torturous process to fight for your own rights, you know, that's where you start interacting with policy. How do you deal with programs? When you go through the rehabilitation process, you know, you learn about your rights. You learn what's wrong in the community. Child marriage, for an example. Domestic violence, for an example, and there are other factors, harmful cultural practices in the community that actually leads to or ignites trafficking. Trafficking itself does not exist in silos. There are community practices that needs to be challenged, patriarchy, for example. So when you learn with the help of a community-based organization, because they are your mentors, so what you start doing, you go back to the community and raise awareness, you start talking. So that's your involvement with programs,
Right.
From being a victim, a survivor, now you are actually talking about the problems. You know, you do workshops at the village level. You talk about child marriage, domestic violence, trafficking. You're not talking about your trafficking journey. You're talking about mitigation, prevention. So that's your involvement with programs. And because you have been through the process, administrative, bureaucratic process of fighting for your rights, housing, food, shelter, all this huge process, paperwork, and so on. You learn to deal with policy. So policy and programs, so your rehabilitation programs and your lived experience of the rehabilitation program. Again, not your trafficking journey, that's not important. The lived experience of trafficking program, rehabilitation program informs policy and program. So that has been the key finding. The second major finding, which actually is a request from the survivors on the ground, we are not survivors. Something goes wrong in our life, you know, doesn't mean that, that single incident should define us. We have personal break-offs, you know, doesn't mean that, you know, people start questioning us. When we meet people, we talk about our careers and what we do in life. Similarly, they would like to be called as rights holder.
Yeah.
Because their rights as a citizen were violated. The state could not protect her. The community could not protect her. The first instance. Remember, they're all below 18, they're children.
Yeah.
So what you're doing when you're coming back as a survivor, you're claiming your rights, state rights. Indian constitution guarantees your basic rights of food, shelter, education. Right to education is guaranteed by the constitution. Indian state has got systems in place to do that. Yeah, it's difficult to get those things out. But with the help of community, you are actually saying, come, give my rights. It's my fundamental rights as a citizen. So I'm not a survivor. Things may have gone wrong with me like everyone else in the world, but here I'm fighting for my rights. And it works, because when you go to a government office and you say that a survivor is here, it raises eyebrows, there's curiosity, what went wrong. But if I go and say I'm a right holder, I demand my rights, you're bound to actually act.
Yeah, that is very interesting. Because there is a big need in us to define in one word the issue that we're working on, and by extension, the people who are affected by this issue. But that's a very powerful to reframe that. To what extent do you think the people who, the right holders, kind of lead the decisions and on how to help other survivors, how to do the prevention work, and I said survivors again, other right holders, how to do the prevention in the community, how to deal with officials. To what extent the right holders actually lead that work and decisions how to do it best?
It's a work in progress, because they're very young, and you have to always remember, in India's case, they're poorest of poor. They do not have the level of education and training that I and you would have it, but they learn. For example, for economic needs, they have a survivor self-help group. In that group, you have a president, you have a secretary, and these are all survivors. So they're learning how to manage, keep books, for example, how to pass a resolution, for example. So every time they go back to the community, when they do these awareness programs, they gain experience. They only get better with time. And so much so now they have become peer workers. So when there's a problem in the community, someone is trafficked or someone is facing domestic violence, things have changed. The community, they're the first point of contact in many cases, because they live in the village. And the region that I'm talking about is Sundarbans, famous for the Royal Bengal Tigers. You know, it's a mangrove, basically. It's in a delta. So the distances between villages is quite, actually, you have to cross rivers at times, and it's full of crocodiles. It's not easy. So mobile phone kind of helps, really. But to get the message across to the center, you know, where the offices are, where action can be taken, it's not really easy. So the survivors on the ground, the right holders, at the first point of contact, that this transformation is happening, you know, from being a victim, a survivor, now you are actually an agent of change in your village. So with time, they are gaining experience, and with experience comes agency, and with agency comes voice as well.
Right, so what do you think should happen? What should be the next steps, and what's the kind of ideal situation that we should be aiming for?
Now, the idea of survivor engagement in policy is meaningless unless they have livelihood opportunities. They don't have mobile phones, they don't have laptops. Even to come for a meeting, you know, it costs them £2, you know, which they don't have. Now, if you want to make them social workers, you'll have to pay them a salary, compensation, really. Their demand is something like £70 a month or £80 a month. The main issue is livelihood. Livelihood that can be locally generated using local resources. For example, in that region, you know, there are a lot of fishes, rivers, you know, something to do with fishery, or, you know, or making them seamstress. So there's a need for a bit of an investment from business side. You know, we all talk about environmental social governance, and businesses have a responsibility, or the corporate social responsibility. So there has to be, you know, investment in the community. And if you do that, you know, you actually solve many issues. First of all, the whole idea of risky migration. You know, migration to bigger cities will stop. You know, and if women are empowered, if they have income in their hands, and this is something I'm telling you from my experience with other projects, they're all amazing mothers, they have children. You know, they are agents of change in the community. Yeah. When you empower women, it makes a lot of difference for generations to come. So livelihood is one single factor that is actually required in those areas. So we have to think a bit out of the box here.
Yeah, I think it's just another example of how you can't really talk about meaningful survivor or right-holder involvement without looking at wider structures that inform and support all that. Anyway, thank you so much. It was very interesting and to hear from you. Thank you very much for coming on to our podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm here with Benedetta Wazonga, Director of Gender Justice and Human Rights at the Centre of Equality, Diversity and Inclusion. Welcome to the podcast, Benedetta.
Thank you.
Could you tell us about your research?
My research was on global definitions of modern slavery and human trafficking in the African continent, with the realities of the people that are mostly affected. There is lack of cognition by policyholders in the African continent in the uptake of the global definitions, in the textbook definitions, provided definitions by survivor leaders, by policymakers, and basically all the stakeholders within the anti-trafficking movement in addressing modern slavery and human trafficking.
Could you tell us what you found within your research?
My research findings were on the following issues. One, consent. That consent is irrelevant in the definition of human trafficking and modern slavery. What we should aim as the stakeholders in the anti-trafficking movement is the forms of exploitation that happen in the process. Some of the research findings were basically on how global leaders would define terminologies and concepts of modern slavery and human trafficking. One of them is there's considerable confusion that prevails about the precise meaning of modern slavery and human trafficking, and that there's no legally defined or a global definition on modern slavery and human trafficking, and that also consent as an element of human trafficking and modern slavery should be disregarded, that at the end result of it all, we should look at the forms of exploitation that take place, and not what the victims or survivors or the person with lived experience has either consented or not.
Could you unpack a little bit more about what you mean by consent and survivor consent?
Most victims find themselves in a limbo. Anytime they find themselves in some sort of exploitation, the blame is placed on them that you consented to this form of exploitation. You consented to be trafficked. You consented to be moved from point A to point B. And in the global definition of human trafficking, it says that one must not have consented. So if you are found to have consented to that form of exploitation that one finds themselves into, then it becomes the problem for the victim, the problem for the survivor to maybe come out of that situation.
That's so interesting. How do you feel that can be resolved and fixed for now and into the future?
if we have in place global definitions that cut across regions, that cut across continents, regardless of where one finds themselves into. For example, I, as a victim of exploitation or as a victim of modern slavery and human trafficking, if I find myself in the UK, then the law must protect me, regardless of whether I consented to be trafficked from point A to point B. If I find myself, let's say, in Kenya, it shouldn't be that because the Kenyan law doesn't provide for the definition of human trafficking and modern slavery. So that leaves kind of a loophole for the traffickers to exploit that gap, that country A has a definition and country B doesn't have. So let me concentrate on my exploitation in country B as opposed to country A.
Benitez, could you tell us a little bit about what you would recommend to solve the problem, what recommendations you found within your research that policymakers and others in the sector can take on board?
Yeah, having in place national and regional definitions are being harmonized by the international given definitions would address this issue. For example, the Convention on Human Trafficking is a convention that has been signed by basically all countries around the world. So if that can be domesticated to all the countries that are trying to address this issue, because we know that human trafficking and modern slavery is a global issue. So being a global issue, having harmonized definitions at the national and regional level with the international standards, then that would address this problem. Again, we need to refine the existing or to elaborate the existing terminologies that will be applicable, that will resonate to the grassroots communities, to the communities that are mostly affected. And finally, we need to align research agendas with the priorities of the people that are most affected.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Benedetta.
Welcome to our next guest to our podcast, Emma Christensen, who is a learning and development officer at Azadi Kenya, and Wills, they, them, who is a lived experience writer, photographer and researcher and Azadi member. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please tell us about your research, what you're doing in this project.
So our research centers on safeguarding. We are a survivor-led, lived experience-centered organization, and safeguarding is very important to us. It is very central to our work. And an additional element that we put into our research was the topic of cultural competency. Intersectionality is a big part of our work at Azadi. And we were banking hard on safeguarding not being able to happen to its full capacity without a full recognition and celebration of everything that the person you're engaging is and everything they are and everything that they contribute to the space. So we wanted to look into what's safeguarding should look like and how it should be conducted, who should be involved, how, what should be central to that process. And we're doing a toolkit on this process. The toolkit is specifically on the interpersonal capacities that a person working with someone with lived experience would need. But we've also delved into organizational requirements, so stuff like safeguarding policies, accountability processes, stuff like that. Last year, we touched a bit on safeguarding on a different research project we did, where Wills, who's with me here, supported us. But this year, we focused almost entirely on safeguarding.
Great. Wills, would you like to tell us about your role in the project?
Yeah. I was shadowing the lead consultant, which was Emma and Caroline. And I was with another survivor leader, and it was my second research project, and it's one of the it opened doors for research community at Azadi, and we started a cohort of training the survivor leaders to look into long-term empowerment through research, and we tap in the lived experience. I think it's a great project to bring to that can bring impact in sustainability. For this one of safeguarding, I was in the focus group, and it went well.
Great. Well, tell us what you found in your research then.
So we found that there needs to be a very broad, holistic focus on the person you're engaging. So they need to be very active participants in their own safeguarding journey. There needs to be a focus on creating really strong relationships that center on trust, that reckon with power imbalances, and that are very participatory. There needs to be very strong feedback and reporting mechanisms, some that can be informal, but others that are very informal. So we're really just opening up spaces for someone to say, hey, this is my feedback, this is what I experienced with this process, this is how we can work together on creating better structures and better relationships. And then there need to be very strong accountability processes that make sure that whenever safeguarding concerns arise, that they are dealt with, they hold whoever was involved accountable, and that we all learn and grow and unlearn also from those processes, so that we make sure that the that we're building towards a more inclusive and overall better safeguarding environment. I think that's like the overall sort of broad strokes.
Yeah, no, that's great. How have you found that the whole process and about your kind of the findings from your perspective?
I think it's a great project, having inclusion of lived experience. It's one of the projects that I was able to join the advisory group for the conference that PEC, GFEMS and Freedom Fund arranged in London. And it's the gateway that got me here in Liverpool. And I'm hoping that if this project can continue, it will create a great impact for the lived experience.
That's great. I'm guessing that that things in terms of safeguarding are not where they should be just yet. What do you think should happen? Where what should we pay attention to? Where what are the recommendations of your research?
So we found that safeguarding in Kenya, in particular, where our scope was, is very badly implemented. It's often donor imposed, and it's usually not very inclusive at all. So we found a very wide gap for safeguarding. It's not where we needed to be. One of the things we're hoping for with this toolkit that we are developing is that it can support a better standardization of processes, so that civil society has the tools that they need to understand how safeguarding can be implemented in an engaging and inclusive way. So we want to distribute it amongst those civil society actors, in Kenya in particular, because that's where our scope has been. Hopefully they can create better safeguarding structures in their organizations. Better relationships can happen between the people engaging and the people engaged. And we can create a better environment for the people we're engaging, where they can feel safe and we can support their holistic healing.
Right. Wills, do you want to add anything to that?
Safeguarding, it's a word that's new, especially to the lived experience. And I have seen it being implemented at Azadi. And I think it was a great project that Azadi and PEC did for safeguarding and actually having some of the findings being implemented. And we hope people can adopt. Maybe Azadi can be the role model for the safeguarding. If it's working at Azadi, it can work anywhere.
Great. Thank you very much for coming to the Modern Slavery Back Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Ling Li, Regional Consultant for Southeast Asia and East Asia. Welcome, Ling.
Thank you.
Ling, could you tell us a bit about your research on scamming and modern slavery?
Yes, sure. So, but I want to start like with my background a little bit. So I have a mix of background. I worked first as in the law enforcement and then in the international organizations. And then I was last year in Cambodia and like searching research for sex trafficking. But then suddenly there's a lot of like I got more than 40 messages from Chinese and Taiwanese nationals and send me distress messages and telling that they are trapped in scam compound. And I, at that time, I was like, oh, what is that? So as the research going deeper, I figure out there's 100,000 of people unlawfully detained inside scam companies. And that's what brought me to this subject. And then I decide, I'm asking myself, what's going on, why the NGOs are not helping, how the system are failing to respond. So that's my research topic.
Can you tell us a bit more about online scamming, what it exactly is and how it affects people?
So when we talk about online scamming, it starts in mainland China and Taiwan, but then towards 2010s, the crime companies moved their servers and operations into Southeast Asia, mainly in Cambodia and the Philippines, and to avoid the law enforcement. Basically, the scam is, we're talking about romance scam, and it affects like normal people when you are using Tinder, LinkedIn, WhatsApp, and there's like a perfect, beautiful person come to approach to you and then being nice to you, it can be a scam. So it needs labor to find clients. That's why they have to, like the criminal groups, they are resorted violence method to recruit. I'm talking about trafficking people, smuggling, or even we have cases, people get kidnapped off the street and to put in that kind of compound. The human trafficking for scamming is a little bit different from the normal form of modern slavery because the profile of the victims are a little bit different. They are slightly more educated. So they can read and write. They know how to use social media. They know how to use laptop. And but again, I'm not saying that the people who have economic disadvantage are still the most vulnerable. So there are overwhelming evidence that there are torture, violence happening inside the compound. So when a lot of people know that scam is a crime, so they try to say, no, I don't want to do this. That's when the people start beating them and threaten them to death.
Gosh. And so how long has this been going on for? Is there a timeline or has it exacerbated from the pandemic? Or
yeah, it starts around 2017-18, but then towards the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's become huge to an industrial scale, to the point that journalists are talking about scamdemic originating from Southeast Asia.
And what kinds of forms do the scamming take? Like what types of forms of online scamming are there?
The romance scam is the main one. I'm just talking about like to picture themselves as the perfect boyfriend and girlfriend. But then it's also can be a friend. It just once you have emotional needs, it's really suited for the new COVID kind of like everyone is lonely these days. You cannot find friend easy. So once you get attached to a person, and then after 3 months, they ask you, okay, I'm actually doing investment. Do you want to add some money? Or like, you don't need to, you just need to like help me to manage this account. So you see all this big amount of money going in, and you say, okay, let me put $1,000 to try. And then the second day you have 5,000 back. Then you say, okay, this person I already know for 3 months. I can trust him. And then that's the scam comes.
And so what did your research findings find from the situation?
The biggest problem. So basically, I interviewed NGOs working on that in the field and also survivors. So the biggest problem is lack of a victim identification system. There are two main reasons. Is first, scam is a crime. So the government are kind of like doesn't want to recognize the victims as victim. They prefer them to see them as criminal because they are scammer, and also they are illegally cross the border. And also for countries like Cambodia, they have a system, but then the system is for the Cambodian nationals, and so for foreigners. The government just cannot, when I talk with them and then they say, how it comes Taiwanese, they are from like developed country, and why they come to Cambodia for search for jobs. It doesn't make sense. So all these stereotype of who are the survivors of modern slavery also make the government lacking of react. But this caused a lot of problem because the NGOs on the ground, they are felt they cannot respond because there's no survivor. And how you can talk about survivor engagement without a survivor being officially identified. And also NGOs say this is not in their mandate because they are mainly working on sex trafficking. So the shelters are for female, for children. But then when we rescue males, and we don't know where to even to put them. So that's a problem. And then the second thing is, It comes like it's following the identification system. So there's it reflects that there's no systematic response from the whole anti-modern slavery movement to new phenomenon. So it's so stay in their own area. And so once there's a new thing comes out and they freak out that what we should do, how we can identify who is that, who is a victim or not. How to cooperate. And it's like 2 years I've been working on this area, but then even until now today, like in Cambodia, Myanmar, NGOs, they still don't have Chinese speaking staff. So you can see the system is super lagging. And the third thing is about trauma. So a lot of NGOs hold the idea that the survivors have to recover before they join, before we talk about survivor engagement. But then, for a lot of people, like human beings, we deal with trauma in different way. So some like to shout out to recover. So is that possible the NGOs can be more flexible and then embrace the survivors? The donor give more fundings to help them recover or give them more capacity building programs? That's a question comes like, as my funding.
That's really interesting, and so interesting to hear about new forms of exploitation and how people are sort of, it feels like dealing with the traditional forms, but when new forms are there, it's almost overwhelming in a sense. That's what I'm gauging from that. So what do you think's next, and how do we change that and really shed a light on it?
So about survivor engagement, well, there's something already been repeatedly talking. It's like we have to do trauma-informed, needs-focused, survivor-led approach. But here, I still want to emphasize the capacity building. The money, the energy is not there on the ground. And then we are treating survivors as a victim and then as a unicorn. Like every time we have a meeting, we take a survivor and they speak their story and then that's it. But then it's a time we switch it to a cooperation-led approach. See them as a colleague, really respect their expertise. That's one thing about survivor engagement. But then for the human trafficking, for scamming, first build the victim identification system. I already talked about the importance. Include the foreigners into the system when we are finding them in the typical South country, and also change the way of thinking about trauma, and that's required the donor really give funding to the survivor-led groups or organizations, let them to decide what they need to learn, how they want to engage. And again, yeah, NGOs just need to be more flexible about their mandate. And then when there's another new form, phenomenon of modern slavery comes in, they are able to say, we can help.
Thank you, Lynn. That was really, really informative.
Thank you.
Welcome to our podcast, Ake Achi, Director of Migrants at Work, an organization led by people with lived experience of immigration status and of race discrimination related labor exploitation. Welcome, Ake.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You introduced a new concept called homegrown slavery. Let's start by explaining it in the context of people coming to the UK on sponsored visas.
So homegrown slavery, it refers to institution and practices similar to slavery or slavery-like practices carried out by persons or entities which constitute an internationally wrongful act of a state. So in a simple words, really, so if you look at in the context of sponsorship, a visa, what is happening is that the employer apply to CQC, for example. If you take the case of care workers, the employer apply to CQC to get a registration in order to become a care provider. Then after they become a care provider, they apply to the Home Office to get a visa sponsorship license. Once they have their license has been approved, then they sign a certificate of sponsorship, which is again approved by the Home Office, which allow them to recruit overseas workers in the care sector or healthcare sector to bring them to the UK. So once they arrive in the UK, so this process from the CQC, so the Care Quality Commission process to the visa sponsorship license, is all under the control of statutory authority. So once they arrive in the UK, many of them then find themselves into a labor exploitation situation. So this is a process really that is created not by criminal, but by a state, which result in exploitation. So that is a reason why we call it homegrown slavery, because this originate from state policies.
In this report, you focused on the engagement of people with lived experience in addressing this issue. What have you found in your study?
So what we try to do, so the main purpose of this report is to investigate the key role of what we call SOLEX. So SOLEX stands for Self-Organized Lived Experience. So we're looking at these SOLEX advocate in shaping policies and program development to address homegrown slavery. The second objective was to investigate the best practice of SOLEX entities acting in the best interest of the community to disrupt homegrown slavery. So the first part or the third objective of this research was to identify the strategy of SOLEX in tackling homegrown slavery. And there was a second part of the third objective, which was to identify the strategy from international and domestic legal framework to address these issues. So what we found is that in the sector, these organizations holding this key role and responsibility are actually not people with lived experience. They are organizations with people who have professional experience who are mainly white people who are running the sector. So that is a little bit concerning, because people with lived experience are now part of the game, I would say. So since people with lived experience are not part of the game, So we look at their contribution, so the contribution of these non-lived experience organization, which in a research we call them surrogate organization. So we look at several actors. So for example, we look at a home office, we look at a gang master led by this authority, we look at a mainstream trade union and migrant support organization. So what we found is that even though they are in the system, they are running the show, I would say, is that they are not able to address these issues accordingly. So the question was, where are the SOLEX organization and why they are not included? So we found two reasons, really. So the first one was related to discrimination, because there is systemic racism in the anti-trafficking sector, but we don't talk about that. The second issue was exploitation. And in fact, in the research, one participant says that his quote was, "We are talking about exploitation in the workplace. We are talking about racism. And so why in the world, all of you are white?" So this was in relation to racism. So these are people with lived experience involved in the sector who are trying to challenge systemic racism, but have also to challenge white-led organization because they are excluded from this sector. And so this is a problem. What we also found is, because of exploitation, for example, I have a quote here where one participant said, "The big charity do not want to be told this, but they drive exploitation. They have reduced people to more than one characteristic of service users." Again, this is concerning because this is a sector where organizations have the objective of tackling labor exploitation, but they are themselves exploiting migrants, the most vulnerable in the sector. The other issue we found is in terms of the funding. So there was one example given by one participant. He was saying that there is a big organization in London, for example, responsible for distributing money. But when they reach out to this organization to get involved in their activities, this organization basically told them that they were not interested in getting involved in anything to do with undocumented workers. Again, this is also concerning that surrogate organizations, which are supposed to work for migrant or in the best interest of migrant, do not want to get involved with SOLEX organization. So this is really concerning. And so as a result of that, what they are saying is that the sector needs to be reformed, but also trafficking needs to be reformed.
You certainly pose a challenge to this sector. And I'm wondering, both from your findings and from your experience of leading an organization led by lived experience, how can we do that? How can we overcome all the issues that you mentioned?
So one of the things that was proposed in the research is that it would be challenging, really, to get either people with lived experience only to do the work. And it needs to be a work that is carried out by people with lived experience, but also with people without lived experience, supporting people with lived experience. And one aspect we found which will be helpful is to take a different approach to look at how a human rights-based approach can be used in a way to kind of shift the structure within the sector, meaning that if you take a human rights approach, people with lived experience will be leading in the sector because they will be the subject, I would say, of all these violations, and it would be the one leading the sector. And so a human rights-based approach is more appropriate, I would say, to try to reframe this kind of engagement in the sector.
Just specifically about addressing homegrown slavery as an issue that is kind of facilitated by the policies of the state, what are the recommendations to address that in terms of, one, addressing the issue, but addressing the issue with people with lived experience at the heart of it?
So because the root cause of the problem is the state, the solution is the state, of course, it's the state policy. So some of the recommendations we are making is that the state works in partnership with people with lived experience. So for example, under the ILO Protocol on Forced Labor, the government is required to develop a national policy and action plan. But this hasn't been done in the UK. So the government needs to engage with people with lived experience to be able to put this action plan, because only people with lived experience involved in the process, it is only this way that we will manage to change the way policy are being made. Because as of now, people with lived experience are not involved and policy are being made with our people with lived experience. So that's one recommendation. The other one was, for example, for the Home Affairs Select Committee to appoint an independent anti-trafficking self-organized lived experience advocate organization to ensure the bilateral agreement between the UK government and its international partners, for example, comply with domestic legislation and do not conflict with existing domestic legislation. For businesses, for example, what we are asking businesses to do, again, is to work with people with lived experience. As of now, businesses are only working with the government or with trade union, and people with lived experience are excluded. And this does not work because they are not involved, and business and the law does not allow this collaboration between businesses and people with lived experience. So trade union by law are allowed to engage in collective bargaining agreement with the state. But for people with lived experience, again, there is no mechanism there. So really businesses need to come together with people with lived experience under the umbrella of a corporate social responsibility to be able to achieve that.
A lot of food for thought, including for ourselves here. Ake Archie, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.